Hello, and welcome to another episode of To FinTech and Beyond, the podcast brought to you by Tribe. This week, we're joined by Jim Wadsworth, who leads the open banking team over at MasterCard, and together we'll be tackling the big question, open banking, what's next? So good morning. Welcome to another episode of To FinTech and Beyond. Today I have the delight of introducing you to Jim Wadsworth, who leads open banking at MasterCard. So Jim, welcome.
Thanks, Alex. Good morning.
I guess before we dig into all things open banking, it'd be great to hear a bit about yourself and, you know, your past and, you know, your role at MasterCard.
Sure. Thank you. So a bit of from a personal perspective, bit of a checkered history, I suppose. You and I have known each other a very long time. Been in and around the kind of payments innovation world for more years than I care to remember, probably pushing 30 now, which is a bit frightening. I've been part of MasterCard, or actually I joined VocaLink, which was obviously then acquired by MasterCard, joined VocaLink about 10 years ago now, having done various roles in different places. I suppose the reason I joined VocaLink at the time was, you know, excited about the possibilities of real-time account-to-account. Frankly, I didn't know very much about it at the time, having built and run a few cards businesses and things like that. So wanted to get involved in that. But for the last 4 or 5 years, I've been leading MasterCard's entry into the open banking market. That's been an exciting journey. In 2018, there was me and a couple of other folks, and that was the open banking team. And now worldwide, it's probably our biggest single area of investment with more than 1,300 people across MasterCard focused on open banking. You know, live in North America, live in Europe, entering markets like Australia and Brazil. And it's just, you know, incredibly exciting. I'm very proud of what's been achieved. My personal role these days, you know, as you can imagine with that growth, lots of folks have got involved. So I now focus on leading our European business specifically. And I suppose the turnkey moment on that was the acquisition last year of a business based in Copenhagen called Aya. You know, that's exciting. We're going through integration of that at the moment. We got, you know, some great clients in the UK, which, you know, we developed through our own activities before Aya joined the family. That continues. Aya's brought some great clients in the Nordics, and you know, there's lots of other exciting stuff going on both here in Europe and elsewhere.
I didn't realize it was 1,300 people. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's big, and you know, there's some of that's come through acquisitions like Aya. In 2020, we did a big acquisition in the US of an open banking provider called Finicity, and at the time of that acquisition, Finicity alone was probably 650 people. And of course, we've sort of invested since then.
You mentioned account-to-account payments with VocaLink or real-time payments, but like, if we take a step back and just try and establish the premise of what open banking is, yeah, I guess it'd be good to understand that from a base level.
At its most fundamental, open banking is all about consumers and businesses granting access to their financial accounts to some sort of third-party organization. So to somebody other than their bank, if you like, to enable that third party to provide the consumer or the business with some sort of service that's valuable to the customer. You know, in some cases, those are data oriented services. So, you know, the most simplistic type of service might be see all of my accounts across multiple banks through one place. And that has, you know, that has some value. I think it has particular value if one is not just presenting the data, but, you know, slicing and dicing, analyzing it in some way, whether that's perhaps to say, hey, did you realize you spent, you know, 50 quid or 50 euros or $50 more this month on groceries or something like that to help, you know, help people understand and to manage their money better. So there are those sorts of services where we actually think the highest single area of value from open banking worldwide is likely to come is, again, a data-oriented service, you know, ultimately to help with lending decisioning. So if you think about it, the flow of funds through one's accounts over a period of time really is the best source of data in many ways for understanding whether you're a consumer or especially actually for a business, the creditworthiness of that individual. Now, in some markets, you know, like the UK, for example, or the US, there are very sophisticated credit reference agencies in place. They often serve the needs of consumers and lenders to consumers very well. But actually, even those markets, small businesses, you know, find it hard to get access to finance in many cases. So actually, opening up the access to that set of data to serve the needs of the lending industry, we think is hugely important in terms of helping with financial inclusion, helping to grow economies faster. If you think about it, small businesses, who are the lifeblood of most economies around the world, if they can get slightly earlier, slightly quicker access to funding, that helps them grow faster, that will help economies grow faster. And of course, post-pandemic, that's what we all need. So there are those sorts of things. But equally on the payment side, there are some great services out there. You know, we think the intersection, if you like, of open banking payment initiation, as we have here in Europe and the UK, with real-time account-to-account is a really great addition to the payments landscape. From MasterCard's perspective, I mean, clearly everyone knows MasterCard in terms of its role, integral role to the cards ecosystem. But when MasterCard acquired Vocalink in 2016 or thereabouts, that was a very clear statement, I think, around what we refer to internally as our multi-rail strategy. You know, so at the end of the day, if our customers and their customers want to transact through mechanism X or mechanism Y, we want to be able to serve all of those needs. You know, we're not, you know, not sort of simply saying you've got to use a card for this or whatever else. Customers will make their own choices about how they want to transact. We want to make sure we're providing the capabilities, a very rich set of capabilities, to ensure that we're adding value to that payment ecosystem, regardless of what the payment happens to be made over, whatever rail it happens to be made over. And payment, you know, and payment initiation through open banking plus real-time account to account, we think is a very powerful combination.
I think the interesting point you talked to in terms of the credit referencing is that it feels like fluid data capture rather than static data capture. So your ability to understand the peaks and troughs of one's account as opposed to a snapshot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right, Alex. I mean, you know, if you think about it from the lens of a gig economy worker with multiple sources of income that are, you know, inherently variable, you know, you look at, you know, what's going through an account today, well, that gives you a view. But if you look at that account over, let's say, 6 months or something, you get a very different picture. And that can be, you know, typical traditional credit analysis methods don't work very well. But if you think about it holistically, then absolutely you get that much clearer picture of somebody.
I think then if we then build on that sort of payment initiation and consumer application, like, I think a lot of the criticism of open banking comes from its awareness or whatever, but why do consumers care? Should they need to care? Like, is that important in this success of open banking?
Yeah, I mean, I think a few things on that. I mean, firstly, consumers shouldn't need to know they're doing open banking. You know, they should know that they're engaging in a service, be that a payment service or a, some form of data-oriented service that adds value to them, that it's secure, that it works. How that happens to be delivered, you know, I mean, in extremis, should a consumer know that there's something called PSD2 or the OBIE or the whatever the hell it happens to be in whichever country? No, of course they shouldn't. It's all about the proposition. So in that, there's no rocket science there. You know, services will get engagement from consumers and others if those services add value, if they work properly, and if they're presented correctly to the customer in question. You know, without wishing to kind of blow our trumpet or our clients' trumpets, for example, here in the UK, you know, two of our sort of turnkey signature, whatever the right expression is, clients are Lloyds Bank and Tesco Bank. They both started with similar use cases, which is basically pay my credit card. So they both have, you know, obviously substantial credit card bases. Some of their customers pay with direct debit, or in the case of Lloyds, you know, kind of a transfer, if you like, within Lloyds systems, and that's all good. But they both wanted to add another payment option to that mix using open banking and, you know, in conjunction with faster payments in the UK. And they've just been spectacularly successful. For our bit, if you like, in terms of the underlying tech works really well, and we're proud of that. But they present those offers, if you like, that payment, those payment options to their customers really well, particularly in the mobile journey, purely mobile journey, app to app type redirect works really well in the UK. I've never seen such positive customer feedback, you know, and the customers are clearly happy, which means that, you know, Lloyds and Tesco are really happy as well. It's really great to see when you get it right, you can absolutely see that consumer engagement. And none of those customers really know there's this thing called open banking. They know that they are paying from their bank account. They see the moment of truth, if you like, in terms of authorizing the payments in question. Of course, they have the journey that's familiar to them in terms of however their bank happens to enable payment, you know, in the same way as if you were setting up a bank transfer in the normal way, you know, whether it's a biometric or whatever you use. So it's also that familiarity. So consumers have that familiarity of experience. You know, they're authorizing the transaction in the same way they do anything else with their bank. And that itself breeds confidence in terms of the whole UX. And of course, there are plenty of other clients, whether they're of ours, and plenty of other players in the market doing exactly the same thing. And if you engineer it right, consumers use it.
I think that's the key. Like, it's always been my trepidation with payment initiation is how do you incentivize or drive an experience that warrants consumer change. Like, ultimately for us in the UK, a real-time payment, you know, has been around for a relatively long time now. So why do I need to use an open banking like functionality? And I think you're hitting on it right. Like, it's the experience. It's ultimately, we're all bloody lazy, right? Can I do things from a more simplistic view with more information? Yes, I'm going to do that, whether there's a cost benefit to my provider or not. I don't care if Tesco's bank has a fixed-based pricing model or a basis point model. What I want is to pay my credit card off as easy as possible.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, remove friction, remove pain. And actually, kind of almost an maybe we should have realized this before the off, but an unexpected benefit is actually reduced customer service overhead for our customers because, hey, guess what? Because the transaction details, you know, destination account, amount, you know, any whatever the reference field has to be for reconciliations, they're all pre-populated. By definition, they're always right. Whereas, you know, if people are manually creating those transactions, of course, sometimes things go wrong, you know, you just transposition of digits or something like that. So there's less hassle, not just for the consumer, but less hassle for whoever the payment recipient is as well.
Yeah, 2022 data versus 85-83 makes a big difference in those sorts of things.
It's not even that, actually, although that clearly, of course, can help. It's just simply the fact that, again, if you engineer these things correctly, all the customer has to do is say, yeah, I want to do it, and want to go through whatever the authorization is with their bank. And all of the boring crap that maybe payments people care about has been done for the customer. They haven't got to think about it.
That makes sense. Hi, it's Alex here, and just a quick word from me to promote our brand new report, Solving the Post-Pandemic's Payment Puzzle, How Can Merchants and Acquirers Satisfy Consumer Demand? Based on a survey of 400 merchants across 5 key European markets, the aim of this research is to understand what payments issues and initiatives merchants are focused on as they resolve to meet consumer demand. We also dive into areas where merchants are seeking support and how payment partners and their acquirers can help. Head over to our website, trypayments.com, where you can download it for free. We've kind of covered the AIS side in terms of credit decisioning, but where do you think PIS evolves into? Like, is it just payment initiation, or is it now account-to-account payments that happens to be underpinned by that? Like, where's your long-term view on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting to see. Obviously, here in the UK, where you and I are both sitting, the so-called variable recurring payment thing is coming soon. And that's going to be an interesting addition to the mix. You know, so today's open banking payments initiation is one authorization equals one payment. But with the advent of VRP, in effect, we will end up with one authorization equals, you know, multiple payments for a variety of different use cases. It's going to be really interesting to see how that gets utilized and, you know, kind of how customers engage with it. But I think, again, it's a really helpful addition to the payment mix, and I think in essence this is just another. This is, you know, in my view, it's another infrastructure that will enable people to get kind of, you know, to enable people to transact with each other, and enable people to transact with each other in an easy and reliable way, and, you know, ultimately underpinned by, existing, known, tried and trusted infrastructures like faster payments in the UK or the equivalent elsewhere?
Yeah, I think there's two points from that. One is, I think VRP, my understanding of VRP is this at the moment, consumer initiated from a standpoint as opposed to merchant initiated. Is that right?
Well, you know, so I think in formal sense, you know, kind of the I mean, firstly, in terms of the underlying plumbing, if you like, there's a mandation as part of the original CMA order in the UK. So the kind of so-called CMA 9 have to enable VRP for so-called sweeping use cases. So, you know, for example, my current account to my savings account or whatever else. But that will get opened up progressively to, you know, on a commercial basis to other use cases. So, you know, kind of, you know, which is a competitor at the end of the day to things like direct debit or to card on file. You know, the initiation mechanism, I think, will, you know, it'll be interesting to see how different people engineer it. But ultimately, a payment offer, if you like, will get presented to a customer by whoever the underlying provider is, be that a merchant or whatever else. They'll need to, you know, this will need to be kind of done in a way that, you know, builds in consumer trust, of course, and appropriate levels of transparency to so the customer knows what they're signing up to. And, you know, of course that will evolve. And as we all have done, you know, with, you know, if you like, single shot payment initiation, we'll all learn how best to kind of tweak the UX for VRP as well.
Yeah, I think that's the reason I asked the question. I think the direct debit competitiveness has a real opportunity, I think, as we evolve. To that point of data, the transparency in data, the information, you know, it took us, what, 20 years for someone to anticipate day two settlement on a BACS file to then notify the customer beforehand. You know, like it's I think a great opportunity, but yeah.
Yeah, and that's not to say direct debit doesn't work. It's a fantastic payment instrument trusted by, you know, millions of citizens in the UK and in many other countries. But it's also clear that a subset, if you like, of consumers don't like the perceived lack of control that they have.
Yeah.
And, you know, VRP has a role to play in that, I'm sure, you know, as one of a number of possible solutions to that, you know, that particular challenge.
So I think the other interesting thing that you're talking about there is also what is also like an orchestration layer to some extent. But you're talking about the ability to manage payments via different underlying payment mechanisms, whether it be BACS, whether it be real-time payments. But obviously, you also alluded to the fact that those change in different markets. So does open banking ultimately become that umbrella, do you think, in terms of triggering initiation of payments across multiple markets, across multiple payment types? Like, do you see that as evolution?
Yeah, good question. So we have payment initiation in the UK and Europe, and, you know, in some ways, UK and Europe led the way on that. I mean, frankly, the world's biggest open banking payment market is the US. But the US is, if you like, what I would categorize as a data-only market today. There isn't payment initiation in the States in the same way that we think about it over here. If you think about what's happening in markets like Brazil, I mean, the uptake of Brazil's real-time account-to-account system, PIX, only relatively recently launched. Extraordinary uptake, not, you know, unrecognizable compared to how long it took FPS to get going in the UK, for example. You know, there are different reasons why that's happened and so on. But I do think that, as I say, that intersection of open banking with real-time is particularly powerful. You know, different real-time account-to-account services in different parts of the world have, you know, greater or lesser richness and sophistication. You touched briefly on 2022 earlier, and of course that is the sort of standard of choice, and the big thing that enables is a bigger payload, if you like, in terms of the data that goes with the payment, which can be very powerful for things like, you know, reconciliation and, you know, building further trust and simplicity into how, you know, the end-to-end experience, if you like, as opposed to just the simple movement of money. I do think that there will be, it isn't happening yet really, other than arguably within the Eurozone and perhaps to a degree within the Nordics. I think you will see kind of more use of this sort of stuff for cross-border and cross-currency payments as well in due course. You know, the world continues to shrink as we continue expectations of digital economies. You know, why do customers care about, well, I happen to be paid in dollar and I want to buy something in euro. Why should I care about all of the intermediate friction? Just go sort it out, financial services industry. And, you know, and of course, you know, and open banking is a small component of that because clearly plenty of things are happening, you know, all sorts of good ways to deal with that problem. And of course, card works really well in that context. Let's not forget that. But it's clearly an addition to the mix.
So interestingly, and you come back to the sort of data centricity of the US versus the UK, Europe, and you talked about as being somewhat leaders. But do you think there's a variance in growth based on regulatory driven versus innovation driven markets?
Yeah, I mean, interesting question. I mean, the US has been doing open banking for, you know, 20 odd years, and, you know, probably half of adult US citizens are probably using some sort of open banking service. They don't realize they are in many cases, because back to where we were talking about earlier, you know, customers don't care about open banking. They care about the service they're engaging with. You know, so it's a very big part of the US financial services jungle. But businesses like Robinhood exist because of open data access, if you like, which in the US grew up through screen scraping, you know, is progressively moving towards API-oriented connectivity, which is just inherently a more secure, better way of doing things. But, you know, it's a journey. You know, clearly here in the UK, we've had open banking. I mean, actually, there was screen scraping type stuff happening here in the UK well before kind of anyone thought of PSD2 or the CMA intervention here. But I think, you know, that has certainly catalyzed all sorts of activity, not just a move to API connectivity, of course, but certainly including that. Yeah, but equally, other countries around the world, they've learned from the UK, they've learned from PSD2 and added, you know, kind of, if you like, a lot of richness to those regulations. I don't know whether Brazil or Australia's regulations would count as the most sophisticated right now. But, you know, both have gone well beyond the confines of PSD2. And one of the things I love about what Australia are doing is, you know, it's already moved towards open finance. You know, so, you know, again, this is awful jargon. And this, you know, as an industry, we love jargon. But the logic, I suppose, being, you know, open banking mainly centers around the checking account. Open finance extends the logic to, you know, I don't know, savings accounts, investment accounts, loan accounts. And in Australia's case, even going beyond financial products towards driving out open access to utility account data, phone account data, that sort of thing. You know, without necessarily knowing what the services will be, but based on a belief, which I happen to agree with, that if it's easy to get access to these sorts of things, service providers will come up with interesting propositions, even if it's just, you know, making switching propositions easier. And so I think, you know, it'll be fascinating to see how, you know, when you write the history of open banking, open finance in 25 years' time, looking back, I think somebody will be able to answer your question, Alex. But I think right now, you'd be guessing, you know, because I think different markets evolve in different ways.
Yeah, it's too early, isn't it? So has it been successful so far, do you think?
Yeah, I think you have to say yes. In that there are lots of really interesting user experiences that have been created, whether that's in, you know, in the US, as we discussed, it's kind of become part of the mainstream just, you know, through market force evolution, or, you know, here in the UK and Europe, there are some really interesting things happening, particularly in the UK, particularly in the Nordics, perhaps some other markets, you know, maybe there's a bit more development needed or whatever else, but, you know, there's some really interesting things happening. You know, has it completely overnight revolutionized everything we do? No, of course not, but we've only been doing this for a few years, and, you know, it takes quite a long time to have a sea change of behavior. You know, direct debit is still growing in the UK in terms of volumes, not growing very fast, but it is growing a bit. Faster payments usage continues to grow very rapidly. But equally, we've seen through the pandemic, you know, kind of massive movement of activity from traditional kind of point of sale to either to e-commerce and or to contactless. You know, when you get an external stimulus like that, you know, behavior can change quite quickly, but generally behavior changes, you know, in a more, you know, over a more strategic time frame, let's say.
Well, I think everyone looks at that pandemic as a sort of generational fast track, right? So that talks to the period of innovation and change we normally see. I think the interesting things will come from, to your point, I think almost the bolt-ons of innovation or productization that sit around it that ultimately drive that growth, you know, whether it be utilities.
That's exactly right, Alex. Nobody wakes up in the morning saying, I want to do more payments. But, you know, and so things which take pain out of that process will always get you know, kind of a certain degree of usage. Of course they will. And it's just a question of kind of customers, you know, discovering these things and or being introduced to them, trying it out, discovering it's easier, and then you get the repeat behavior.
Can you talk to any beyond AI, I'm going to say, if I'm allowed to say that, any really cool, interesting use cases that you've seen that like people might not be aware of, some of the applications?
I mean, you know, kind of in the UK, obviously there's a lot, you know, I think credit to central government and HMRC in particular in terms of showing some leadership there and adding in other, progressively adding in other other kind of way. Again, none of us wake up saying, oh, I must pay my taxes today. But, you know, kind of anything which takes pain out of those processes for consumers and businesses, you know, credit to them for doing that. I've touched on the lending use case. We've seen the acquisition of Credit Kudos by Apple. I think, you know, kudos to the Credit Kudos guys. I thought they, you know, I think they've done an amazing job of, you know, kind of building a business pretty much from scratch, leveraging the data access and showing what's possible. There are plenty of other businesses out there leveraging the data, particularly for that lending use case. But, you know, there are some other things, you know, coming along in the background. We all talk about the intersection of open banking and digital identity. In the UK, that hasn't yet quite worked out. You know, partly I think, you know, lots of governments have tried now and again to do sort of identity cards and things like that in the UK. And then, you know, that tends to be unpopular for whatever reason here. But if you look at the Nordics, where, you know, digital identities have been around, is all pervasive and normal and part of society, you can kind of see how well that works, just as, you know, again, streamlining user experiences and so on. You know, so I think that there's more to come in that environment. But yeah, there's, you know, there's lots of really, really interesting use cases out there. I mean, there are lots of slightly dull ones as well. There's lots of kind of, you know, look at my account, look at your account somewhere else type propositions, and all they are data presentment. And I'm not, you know, maybe I'm biased or maybe it's me, I don't know. I don't think those are particularly interesting. The ones that add in those, some of those just simple insights that we talked about earlier, I think there's some really, you know, there's some good ones there. And there's some stuff going on I really like that's targeting people with, you know, potentially in financial difficulty, you know, really helping people manage their way out of difficult situations by really helping them understand what's really going on with their cash. And I think there's, you know, those, and they're kind of large, they're not commercial services particularly, but I think, you know, from when you start to think about true financial inclusion and help and financial education, there are some fantastic services out there.
I think the education, the thing that triggered when you said that is that education piece, like their ability to understand their finances, how they understand cash flow, comes back to that sort of middle-aged discussion of should we be teaching finance in earlier education. But open banking feels like it can play quite a good role with a GoHenry, a whatever that OSPA, or even a Revolut Junior, whatever. But
I totally agree. I mean, it's an area, I think this is not unique to the UK. Lots of countries around the world, you know, financial education is a gap. People aren't taught how to budget. They aren't taught how to manage their money. That, you know, kind of when you're in a world where you have easy access to credit, you know, I'm not criticizing anybody here now, but you know, it can be too easy for people to get themselves into trouble. So I think absolutely the data presentment coupled with smart analytics, I think has a very important role to play in helping with education.
The other thing you mentioned earlier was Apple. I think I'd be remiss to not ask what you see big tech's role in open banking and what they sort of play in the future of this space.
Yeah, I won't talk about any one organization, but you certainly see the different players as a minimum looking to get educated and to understand what the art of the possible might be. And, you know, and in some cases have got some early services going in some country or other. I think one of the interesting things from the perspective of any global brand is that open banking is at the moment a series of multiple parallel national implementations, you know, which have their own local peculiarities, be that API standards or regulatory environments, or, you know, what you can and can't do. I mean, you know, just at a simplistic level, in Europe, we're used to payment initiation. Now you can't do that in the same way in the States. So you've got a very, you know, again, it's reflective of kind of being an early stage, immature market. And one of the things from a sort of a MasterCard perspective we want to do strategically is help. A, we want to help open banking and open finance be successful. But secondly, we want to, you know, kind of do, help it to do so in a world that ultimately can create some of that almost leveling up, I suppose. However, we achieve that through making it kind of more usable on a more consistent basis. Because absolutely, when you kind of look at it through the lens of somebody who's got customers, you know, 150 or whatever it is, countries around the world, you know, 60 or 80 of whom are on some journey on open banking, of course, they want to use that sort of stuff, you know, if it adds value to their propositions. But, you know, they also stereotypically don't want to have to do 60 or 80 or 100 local implementations. They want to be able to do stuff, if not once, then, you know, a handful of times. And so it's incumbent on the industry to rise to that challenge and provide capabilities and solutions that serve that sort of need.
It feels like an evolution of MasterCard's origination, right? Just acceptance, that ability to drive an acceptance of a product at a national, global, international stage.
Yeah, scale is everything in payments, as we know. And I think, you know, this is going to be true, you know, for open banking to kind of reach, you know, kind of at the moment we have a, you know, what I would categorize as, you know, got, you know, open banking is a child that is growing really nicely and really engaging. We've got to get this to adulthood, if you like. There's a lot we have to do still.
What are those next things that we need to do?
There is an ongoing thing around service providers understanding how to introduce these sorts of topics to consumers. You know, there are some great success stories, but, you know, there's plenty more to be done. I think from a European perspective, you know, we've just actually, you know, we and many others have just responded to a consultation from Brussels around the move to open finance. We think that's, you know, opening up more data sources is absolutely the right thing to do, very important. And appropriate. Again, let's, you know, there are lots of good things in PSD2 around, you know, balancing, if you like, the innovation agenda with consumer protections. I think PSD2 on the whole has got that in it, has done that pretty well. So, let you know, as we move towards opening up other data sources, you know, maintaining that balance is right and appropriate, I think. But also, actually, perhaps one of the challenges of PSD2 and open banking regulation, you know, there's no doubt it's been very costly for the banks to kind of, you know, expose all of this data. Clearly, the data is the consumers, and PSD2 makes that clear. But I think it's also right and proper that the custodians, let's call it, of customer data, that, you know, should be able to, in some shape or form, you know, actually earn a turn from, you know, from the provision. So I think that, you know, kind of the, you know, I think a more commercial model is going to, I think, will be helpful, you know, over time as well, because maintaining high quality APIs that are, you know, 24/7 available, 3, 4, 5 nines availability and all that sort of stuff, that doesn't come for free. So I think, you know, kind of having a something that, you know, balances, if you like, the data provider, data recipient type model is going to be important as well.
Yeah, sort of API monetization stuff seems to be a common discussion there.
Back to your earlier point, you know, how do you enable that at scale? And, you know, we think we've got, you know, some skills in that sort of area. There are others have as well, but we're certainly seeking to play our part in that maturing of the ecosystem.
Do you think there's anything, so this is kind of a selfish question, I guess, but we were quite early as a processor into the open banking space, but how do we engage non-vital participants? So a processor doesn't have to play a role in this, right? There are several providers around this. How do we entice other parties into the ecosystem to ultimately grow the value of the pie? My sense is you talk about volume will be dictated by usage, which will be dictated by underlying providers. How do we grow the size of the pie?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one question from a payments lens is where are transactions moving from if they're going to, you know, let's say some sort of open banking based engagement? And I think that in itself is a rich and complicated mix. You know, I think going back to the HMRC example, so some people today might pay their tax still by, you know, sticking a check in the post. Others might have used their debit or credit card. Others might have manually created a bank transfer, you know, with a certain level, perhaps with a certain level of errors. You know, so I guess one question is where you know what's being cannibalized.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean. because, you know, whilst it's true that if it's easier to transact, you'll see a certain, you know, the overall cumulative world of payments may go up a little bit, you know, unless you're kind of making lots of people, lots more people and lots more businesses, and or making the average transaction size smaller, you know, will the holistic total volume change inclusive of cash payments and things like that? Well, maybe not. So it's more about where are you moving the transactions from. And we still have, whilst, you know, in the UK, fairly recently, what is it, 3-4 years ago only, cash suddenly stopped being the number one payment instrument. Oh, sorry, stopped being the majority of payments. It's still the number one single instrument, even post-pandemic, I suspect. I haven't checked that. That's me guessing. I haven't checked that data, but I bet it is. And so actually, quite a lot of this sort of stuff is thinking about reinventing maybe how you know, in interactions between customers and merchants. Contactless has done an amazing job. The pandemic helped that in some ways. I can't remember the last time I paid cash for anything. I bet you're the same. But I think there is something about thinking about kind of where's the transaction moving from if it's moving to open banking. There is definitely something about, and we spend quite a lot of time with our clients on this, not just on payments, but on data use cases as well, helping the customer leadership team, the proposition folks, understand what this stuff can be used for, where it can help, and frankly, where it can't. But also based on an understanding of what are their real business problems, what are their constraints, what are their pinch points, where are they trying to maybe shave cost or grow revenues, and actually rather than, you know, and I think one has to actually have a, you know. And I personally enjoy this sort of stuff, but it makes for a slow sales cycle, there's no doubt. You know, having the strategic conversation and really thinking about it, thinking it through, not quite from first principles perhaps, but not far off, because there's all sorts of things you could do with this stuff, but does it actually help the customer, and does it help the client in question? And the answers will vary. And I think it does also mean, because this is kind of reflective of its overall immaturity, we're all still finding out what really works and what maybe isn't. Maybe is a bit of a waste of time.
Yeah. Well, it will ultimately be identifying the problem and then seeing if open banking is the solution, as opposed to it having to be the solution to an unknown problem.
And in that sense, it's back to kind of classical marketing, in this case, B2B marketing and B2B proposition development, rather than kind of, you know, crowbarring in open banking just because that's what my target is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Awesome. I've run out of questions and managed to waffle my way to one that I wasn't planning to ask. So rather than reinvent some few more, we always finish with the same question, because it seems like an interesting thing to ask everyone. But sort of in your view around fintech, like what's the thing that's yet to happen? What do you think we still haven't seen?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think there are so many really interesting ideas out there, not just in and around the open banking space, but certainly inclusive of it. I touched on digital identity earlier. That'd probably be the one I'd call out. You know, there are lots of really interesting solutions out there. How you go, I mean, we're all in payments used to the chicken and the egg thing in terms of having enough payers and payees who want to use the same thing. I think the chicken and egg problem is turbocharged, squared, cubed, quadrupled, if you, or whatever it is, for us to get to a digital identity world. I think getting to that point, having pervasive digital identities that are accepted in, you know, multiple environments, with, you know, not just the financial sector now, but, you know, across our lives, I think, you know, has potential for creating huge efficiencies for all of us. There are lots of really interesting solutions out there. Net of the Nordics, where the government mandated it years ago, none of them really got going yet. You know, we have our role in that. We have some really interesting pilots going on in Australia at the moment. But how do you get to scale in that? Because they only work at scale. And when they're at scale, it's amazing and it's transformational for national economies. But how do you get there?
Well, I guess we'll find out.
Hope so.
And just before we go, Jim, where can we find a bit more about you, MasterCard, and the world of work that you're doing with open banking?
No, thanks, Alex, and thanks for the time today. Yeah, if very happy to pick up with anybody if they're interested. Best way to get hold of me, jim.wadsworth@mastercard.com. So that's WADSWORTH@mastercard.com.
Perfect. Thanks for your time today, Jim. It's been a super interesting conversation for me and hopefully the listeners as well.
Likewise. No, thanks a lot. Good to see you.